Welcome, travelers. I'm Josh.
I'm Glenn.
And I'm Lee Wanika, and this is Tabletop Journeys, where we will be your not-so-humble guides on the quest for RPG adventures.
Here at Tabletop Journeys, we are all devoted role players and storytellers at heart, and we absolutely love sharing our passion with you. On our show, we feature diverse tabletop RPG systems, demonstrating them through actual plays and breaking down the rules to provide you with tips, tools, and techniques to help you navigate them. We also love bringing the content creators behind these games into the studio to give you a peek behind the curtain with relevant and insightful interviews.
Let us help you get the most out of your story, no matter what game world or system you're playing, because detailed settings, heroic characters, diverse NPCs, and a focus on story over rules can make any campaign legendary. Now, here's a message from friends of the show.
What up, Nerd Nation? Steve here from the Dads with Nerdy Ambitions podcast, or DNA for short, your go-to podcast for all things nerd culture. You want to know fun facts about the latest movies? Done. Interested in a new hobby? We've got you. Have questions and want to hear from the experts? Say no more. Join me and my crew every week to hear about our latest takes on everything nerdy and go on a few tangents on the Dads with Nerdy Ambitions podcast, where we know it's not just a hobby, it's hereditary.
Welcome, everybody, to today's episode. Really excited to be cracking into our topic this evening. As you saw, Mr. Miller with a preview earlier in the week revealing what this episode is going to be about. But before we get into that, my two co-hosts, the inimitable Lee Wanika Miller, the amazing Glenn Myers. Gentlemen, how the heck are you? What's going on in your necks of the woods?
Things are going really well. I had an amazing TTRPG weekend.
In addition, yeah, you were busy.
I was putting in some work. Dice were thrown. Adventures were had.
Big adventures, no less.
Yeah, big adventures, no less. To fill everybody in, I did a fair amount of prep time late in the week. I also recorded a brief little treatise on our topic tonight to just touch base and send out to the world, hey, like, we're looking at this and we're pretty excited. So I did that, went into the weekend, ran our actual play adventure for Star Trek Preservations. We had a fantastic episode, really had some great moments, some pathos, character moments, did a lot of cool things. We got together to record with our guest an actual play that our audience will hear over the next few weeks, which was a ton of fun. Big adventure game, which was just wow. Got on to Sunday. I also ran for our Patreons, Star Trek Expeditions. Again, another fantastic adventure. And then Monday night, closed out the actual play episode with a big action sequence. And honestly, just one of the best action sequences I've ever run for Star Trek to date. It was just fantastic. So many great moments. Like, I can't wait for the audience to hear it.
Excellent. Yeah, I saw you recording all over the place there. And so glad I know, too, you were in Preservations, obviously, on Saturday and then Monday afternoon. Uh-huh. But what the heck else you been up to? Yeah,
I had half of Lee Wanika's weekend with him because Preservations on Saturday. And then I had an amazing time with Big Adventure Game as well. Y'all get all the deets on that when those episodes start rolling, because we did an interview with the game's creator, Alex, and then we did an actual play, and then we're going to do a follow-up. So you'll get 6+ episodes on that game to really get the details on that.
It'll be a lot.
Coming up soon. But it was a great time. And then it's a travel time for us. We're on our way back towards New England. So tonight I am in Mount Holly, New Jersey, pulled into a Cracker Barrel and recording with y'all before hitting the hay and pulling into Connecticut tomorrow.
Excellent. Well, be glad to have you back in New England again. I know you've been away for a while. But yeah, let's go ahead and get started because we have some things to discuss. And tonight we're going to be doing a deep dive into Star Trek Adventures 2nd Edition Quick Start Guide. So they released this Quick Start Guide from the point that we recorded probably about 2 weeks ago now at this point. We've been poring over it, poring through it, pulling out what the differences are from 1st Edition, reading some of the other stuff, reading some of the tea leaves about kind of directions that they're going and everything like that. So we're going to do one of our 6 takeaways episodes where the three of us are going to talk about a couple things that stood out to us that was different in this guide from the originals. I guess with no further ado, gentlemen, fan roll dice to the ready. Let's see who gets to get this show started. That's a 5 for me, so not me. Although we are playing STA, so are we rolling low?
You don't really roll initiative in STA, but we could go low anyway.
Details.
Yeah, it's still honoring the game with low. Yeah. Sure, we'll go low for you, Josh, after you rolled. Way to finagle that one for yourself. Teen, which isn't so great today.
I was going to say for round 2, we should set a difficulty, roll 2, and then see who gets the most number of successes. I rolled a 7, by the way.
All right. So that means that I get to go ahead and get started. So that's great. I love this.
Yeah, you get to lead off. Yeah. You win with a 5.
I win with a 5. That never happens. Go figure. You know. So, all right. So tonight I am going to start talking about something that we have done a lot on preservations because we've used them for a variety of different purposes, and there are going to be some pretty interesting changes to extended challenge mechanics. And the reason why I think this is one thing that's going to really have a big impact on preservations in particular, I think, because, you know, Liu and Nika, you and I have talked about this before, that the way that we approach extended challenges is not really truly extended challenges in the way that they're written in the book. They are more like a series of gated challenges. And if you really dig through the storyteller's book, you'll understand what we mean. But basically what we do is we say, there are 5 things that need to be done. They should happen in this order. Each of them has a narrative piece or a mechanical piece that will benefit or hinder the party as complications get rolled and everything like that. And then once they've completed those 5 things, then the extended challenge is complete. Glenn, that probably feels familiar in terms of the way that we structure them, because we don't just say, you have to go ahead and do a thing. Here's all the work that needs to be done. Have at it. How are you accomplishing it? Give each gate a kind of a narrative reason or something that happens when that gate happens.
Right. Very true.
So that's by definition in 1st edition, that's not actually how extended challenges work. I think Lee Winnick and I just like running it that way because we like running a really narrative kind of flow in that. And what I think is most interesting is that with a couple of modifications, extended challenges now are going to very much be like that going forward. Luminika is going to talk in a minute about challenge dice. We're not going to get into that, except to go ahead and say that now your success, once you succeed on your task in an extended challenge, it is now based on the department that you, your department rating in terms of how successful you are. And that now as things go along, as these extended challenges go along, while it can be modified with momentum and resistance, everything like that, you're now able to impact that extended challenge in a much more direct fashion. And that the breakthroughs are, again, they're going to be more narrative by design in the extended challenge system. And I think that, so first off, I love that the rules are going to be supporting the way that we felt extended challenges sang. There were Joe Harney, who plays Captain Tobor, had commented on this in an episode last season that was basically the entire episode was a long extended challenge. And that's not something that you hear on actual plays because they can be really boring. But because we were able to make them narrative, they worked. It sang. That episode worked. Yeah, so I'm really excited that kind of like the way that we're viewing extended challenges is going to become a little bit closer to the way that they are in the actual rules.
Yeah, Josh, you hit the nail on the head, especially very early on when we started season 1. We were very not willing to get into extended challenges. It looked complicated. It felt complicated. On some levels, it was complicated.
Yeah.
I think I have done them, I think, by the book fairly well, but my brain doesn't math all the time. So it took additional resources. I had some online assistants that automated lots of the processes, but even that did not factor in all of the things that could be included in an extended challenge. So the use of the challenge dice, the resistances that were there, breakthroughs and how that worked was something that I did. Fortunately, one of our players had been playing long before he joined our troop, so he knew a lot about how to do this. So we were able to mechanically tough it out and get through those ways. But I can tell you, when I have run at conventions and when I have run at my local store and I notice where we are for time, an adventure, a module, or an adventure that I've written with an extended challenge, and I did just what you said. I made it a gated challenge, or I made it a simple challenge and just made it more complicated because there wasn't enough time to go through all those pieces and make it sing. So the fact that they're making changes to that, I love how that's going. I love the way that feels. Glenn, you've played and played through real ones, pretend ones, partial ones, full ones, all you've done many of them without even knowing which ones were which necessarily. What are your thoughts on that?
Oh, no, I can pick out which ones were which a lot of times, especially as we've talked about the mechanics as it's gone. And I got to say, I definitely have preferred the ones that y'all have done that were more narrative because I understood what we were doing more because the narrative supported the roles as opposed to just, okay, we're trying to take work off of this task and then saying, I'm going to throw out this die and see if I get a success. It's all just literally very box checky and not that interesting math progression. It's very crunch to just roll and see how many successes you get and how much work you accomplish without the narrative pieces of how we're doing it, who we're including, and how it's impacting the overall work and the scenes in the ship and or space station in the instance of our longest set of extended challenges when we were trying to get Aslan Station up to par, which was the episode we were talking about where the first episode, like the first half of that play session, which was an entire episode of the show, was nothing but us rolling dice in different departments and trying to get Aslan Station up to par and online with all of the systems that it, and departments that it needed to have to be a fully functioning Starfleet space station. And they've always been a good time. They've never just been meh. But the ones that you guys have put more narrative weight behind and put more narrative weight behind the outcome and each step or gate as we've passed through it, they've had a lot more impact on the game and been a lot more interesting. They've been more fun to play.
Cool.
Excellent. Thank you. I appreciate that.
Yeah.
All right, Mr. Miller. Yeah. On to you, sir. What do you got?
So I'm going to go with a brief conversation on challenge dice because it follows the challenges itself. Challenge dice are weird because they specifically don't mention them in the adventure, which is because we know from various links, blogs, and articles in different avenues and conversations on the Facebook pages that challenge dice are going away in second edition. And while there are some who are like, I've put a lot of resources in and I have these things, I have these dice, and what am I going to do with them? I say, I've got a bunch too. I actually have plans for what I'm going to do with my Star Trek challenge dice. I have good ideas for those. But again, I strongly feel that the elimination of challenge dice from the mechanical process of this game is a huge boon to the success of this game, future success of this game, and the future adoption of this game. We just did an episode, not even a week ago, where we talked about what games are best to get new players to play. One, you lower some of the cost of entry, so now you don't have to buy special dice. Two, you lower the complication factor by eliminating challenge dice. You eliminate some of the complexity of the extended challenge. Now GMs can run that better, which means they're smoother, which means players will enjoy it more. It's more narrative. It's all those things. And players will get it better simply because that's not part of that. To the conversation about why should a phaser be the same damage all the time, I simply say, narratively speaking, look at the Star Trek shows. There's no question. A phaser has a setting. The character sets the setting, whether you do that by action, by free action, or by threat or momentum spends, you set the actual damage on the weapon.
Yeah.
It doesn't alter. Well, I say this. What alters is plot armor. plot armor are
well, right.
That's why some phasers burn a sleeve or disintegrate a minor character versus a big character. So that still exists, but guess what? That's why we have threat and momentum. You can do different things with that narrative to mirror the shows. The biggest thing I've always said, or we've always said about this game, is it mirrors the shows better than any previous Star Trek role-playing game. So I absolutely love the fact that we have this elimination of challenge dice. So you are deciding what damage you're going to do. The resistances of whatever you're firing at are what count. It has a static damage. If you want to make it hit harder or hit more deeply, you spend the threat or spend the momentum necessary to do so you get a harder hit. It's not random. You don't get that, I'm a Starfleet officer, I'm a veteran of 40 years in Starfleet and all of a, or 20 years in Starfleet, and now all of a sudden I can't even shoot a target with a phaser and do some modicum of damage. Yeah. That's not a good feel. That's just not a good deal. Yeah. This allows that part to be static and allows you to still manipulate that with the meta currencies that the game provides.
I think one of the coolest things with that system that they're introducing is the whole concept of injuries instead of just basing everything on stress. And if you receive enough stress, you blah, 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 that's something, but you can get specific injuries that are caused by these weapons based on the weapons that there are. And I wonder how closely that's going to intertwine with the scar system that we see in the Federation Klingon War book by Al Spader, because the scars, they're like a PTSD or physical scar type thing. So I wonder how the injuries and that system are going to intertwine. And I think that there's a lot of really interesting crossover in there. So yeah, totally agree with you what you're saying. The barrier to injury stuff in particular that you're talking about, exactly where I think is the most important decision. So
even as a player, I'm excited to see those changes and how they come out. I want to see more on how the injuries work. But while the challenge dice were cool, and this may not be the popular opinion, I've never been a fan of them. Part of that is because I live a mobile lifestyle, and sometimes I'm recording in a very small space, like my car, or playing. So I'm using digital dice a lot. And the problem with the reason the challenge dice are complicated is because they're basically D6s, but instead of counting as D6s, they have three different possible results. So effectively, even though you're just rolling D6s, it's not as simple as just adding them up. It adds crunch to the game, and it takes time to figure out. If I'm rocking a phaser rifle like I was in last night's game, I'm throwing out 9 challenge dice to figure out my damage. And I've got to keep track of how many ones, how many twos, how many deltas, and how many things that don't count. That's 4 different things I've got to keep track of as I roll all of these dice. And if you're using a digital roller, sometimes you can't roll 9 at once. The one that I use, I have to do 6 and 3. So now I've got to keep track of them between 2 things. So overall, that was a piece of the game that was just more, in my opinion, more complicated than it needs to be. Despite its coolness factor added more complication than the coolness alleviated. So
Glenn,
I like
you,
it.
Yeah, Glenn, you hit it right on the head. It is more complex than it needed to be. It's not that it was too complex. It was just more than was necessary.
There's unnecessary complication.
And any time you can eliminate that which is not necessary from something that is wonderful, you take something that's wonderful and make it amazing.
You streamline it a little bit more. Exactly. Polish it a little bit more, and you let it shine a little bit more.
And now you get to, in a future state, that same adventure we ran last night, you get to use a phaser rifle. It has static damage. You're not rolling, counting it out. Somebody else on the other side of the screen is not writing it down for you, so you guys have that figured out, then telling me. We rolled dice for just over 50 minutes last night, trying to get about a 45-minute scene out of the way, just in the challenge dice, because it was all an action sequence. Just in the challenge dice alone, I am convinced we could have eliminated close to 10 minutes of gameplay. That makes a world of – now think about that over the course of a campaign. We do a couple action sequences, 3-4 a season. That's a whole hour of game time we get back over the course of a half season even. Think about that. Mm-hmm. And that's just out of the conflict situations. Also add in the extended challenge situations. Now we're talking about getting back 2 or 3 hours. We're basically gaining a session for every season of this show we run simply by eliminating that the challenge dice. I can't think of a better way to make the game better. That's probably one of my number one favorite things that they're doing, except for the thing I'm going to mention next.
For my biggest takeaway reading this document, it actually really highlights the thing that I am the most excited about with a second edition coming out. And that is rules consolidation. As a player, I don't know the rules as well as Josh and Lewinika. That's a fact. And I have not tried to wade through the many books that's necessary to compile a full understanding of the rules, especially with new ones coming out that introduce cool new rules, like we just mentioned, stuff that came out in the new Klingon book. Each book has some new coolness, but they are all spread out through all of those books, right? And for anybody who's tried to pick up the original Star Trek Adventures main core rule book, it is not the most user-friendly manual. It's even the rules that are in it are spread out and not that easy to find or follow. I am super excited. Reading this second edition quick start guide was the most concise, understandably written, and illustrated description of the base mechanics for the game that I've come across yet. Between all of the books that I've gone through, following Lewinika's advice of where to start, because don't start with the core book, start with the starter set, because it was organized with better flow through there. But in this quick start guide, you've got a concise listing, thought out order, complete with flowcharts, and better examples than we've had previously to help understand how they work. And though there are a couple of small differences from the player perspective on what I've read so far, for the most part, this summarized the rules that I'm already using, and I understand them better now just from having read it. And that's not a knock. Modiphius has put out a fantastic game, but they've learned a lot as they've gone. And I think that a reorganization in a second edition is going to be a beautiful thing. I think it is very called for. I think it's a great time for it. It's not like the game just came out last year. We've only been playing Star Trek Adventures for a year, but it's pushing a decade on the first version of the game is not bad at all. No. Almost 10 years later is fine for a second edition. And it'll be a wonderful opportunity to take those cool new rules that they've been developing in the latest books, bring those chief into the front and highlight them in the new rule set, and trim away some of the stuff that was bogging it down, like challenge dice. And I think we're going to be in a fantastic place when it's all done with a nice, neat little bow on top of it. I'm super excited.
I totally agree. When we first talked about STA Second Edition coming out a couple of weeks ago, and Lumine, this may have just been a conversation with you and I, that was one of the things that we said. And actually, even if you go
I was in that conversation because I said
you were.
Looking forward to a consolidation of the rules.
Even if you go back to when we first talked about STA almost a year ago, right, when we talked about the core rules and how much difficulty there was in parsing together what's the game in here? Like, where's the game? I'm having trouble seeing how the game actually works. I like to think that Jim Johnson and his writing team and everything have heard that feedback and said, how do we fix this? And what I'm seeing in the quick start lays this out really nicely. Even just things like when you start talking about the tasks, there's a whole vignette on difficulty zero tasks, which was one of those things that I never thought even existed until somebody had pointed out, like, oh, difficulty zero tasks. Of course there's a difficulty zero task because we're Starfleet. Sometimes things are just automatic, and that gives players the ability to start getting that momentum or buying or using threat, stuff like that. Here's a paragraph on exactly what this thing is supposed to be using, how to use momentum, how to use threat, how to do all these things. It's brilliant. Absolutely fantastic. So I appreciate them hearing that feedback and taking it to heart that we want this game to sing. And it sounds like it's making it easier to let that happen.
I absolutely concur. I think Jim Johnson and I think Modiphius as a whole has shown us with this quick start guide how much faith and support they have for the STA and the Star Trek community as a whole, because they're supporting us. They have been listening. I spend a lot of time on the Star Trek Adventure Facebook group, No lie, anybody who's there knows that I'm always posting, always responding, asking questions, answering questions, pointing people in various directions, celebrating other people's victories and cool things. But what I've noticed in the last few weeks, and this individual has always been there, but Nate Dowdell, the creator of the system or the chief architect of the system, has been a little bit more prominent in the last several weeks, answering some questions about original intent in the original game. And what I find interesting is some of the changes that we are seeing happening were part of a clarification on the original intent. So it's not like these things weren't always supposed to be there. They just, maybe they weren't explained quite as well as they could have or should have been, or it wasn't as clear as it could have or should have been. And I think that's an important aspect of this second edition. It is giving the team who put this together in the first place, in conjunction with the team who's been moving this game forward, a chance to get all the pieces and parts that they wanted. We are seeing some changes that, quite honestly, have always been a part of the game, and I would wager may have been part of the way some of the creators of the game were originally were playing it all along, because they knew about that even if we didn't, right? Look, this is a great game, but everything can be improved, and I think that's what we're seeing here. Flowcharts, better for my ADHD brain, easier to follow, all of those things. I can't celebrate it enough.
All right, we're going to step aside for our mid-episode break here, but we will be right back with three more things. Yeah, we'll catch you on the other side.
Here at Tabletop Journeys, we've leveled up our game, and we're prepared to make your next roll legendary. We've just started a partnership with FanRoll Dice, and they have over 300 product options to choose from. Gemstone, metal, new liquid core dice, and so much more. Better yet, listeners to the Tabletop Journeys podcast can get 10% off on their orders when they follow the link below and use discount code PODCAST10. A portion of these purchases come back to us, and this is a great way for you to help support the show.
Back with the second half of the episode. Gentlemen, fan roll dice to the ready. Let's see. So before I roll, since I got accosted last time, are we rolling low or rolling high?
Oh, we've decided we're rolling low, and okay, we're rolling two D20s.
Yep. We're going to set the difficulty at two successes. Okay. I think for fairness, we're all seasoned players and or GMs, so we'll just say...
like a 12...
Yeah, 12, I think, is fair for
let's say success. 12. Difficulty of 12. All right.
So we don't need a difficulty for how many successes?
Yeah, we'll do it as a zero.
Whoever gets the most successes.
Gets the most. Fair enough. Right. It's a zero fair challenge. Enough. We just need to know who has the most.
I'm going to spend momentum to get a third die.
You didn't start with momentum tonight.
Oh, then I'm going to spend threat to get a third die.
Exactly, yeah. Thus is the difficulty here. So with my two dice, I have a 3 and 11. So by my 12, that's two successes for me.
Oof, I have one success.
I have one success. So Josh, you're going first. Right. And Glenn, my single success was a 5. What was your success?
A 10.
All right, looks like I'm going second again.
We're going in the same order, exactly. Okay, I love that. Of all the times we do this, that very rarely happens that we go in the same order. This is somewhat related to actually what Glenn was talking about earlier with kind of the overall organization of the book. But I will say the one thing that I loved reading through the Quick Start Guide was how explicit they made the storytelling piece of this game. There's the entire section on complications, success at cost, complications at range, examples of complications, how to spend your momentum, how to spend your threat, things that you can go ahead and do, detailing it in explicit detail, in living color, right there in the book. Here are the things that you should be doing to go ahead, how to go ahead and add scene traits, how to go ahead and do all of these things in the Quick Start Guide, which is exactly the place that you want to have it in this level. I love my Game Master's Guide. I read it from time to time just to go ahead and brush up on the rules as things are going by. And it's a 200-page book. There's a lot in there. There's a lot of detail in there. And sometimes trying to find that through line is a little bit difficult. seeing it here, where I can look at four or five pages in the quick start and get, here are the things that I need to do. Here are the complications that I have. Here's how to go ahead and add a complication. Here's what a complication is. Here's how to go ahead and add them. Here are things that I can go ahead and do with my threat. Here are things that I can do with momentum because I can use them interchangeably. It's all, this is all just great. It is fantastic. So from a storyteller point of view, giving me everything that I need. We've talked about this with other systems also, about how when we're reading through adventures and when we're reading through books, the thing that they don't do is tell a storyteller how to run that game, right? Here is STA now saying, oh, storytellers need to go ahead and know how to run STA. It's not just about players knowing how to play it. You don't become a good storyteller in STA by learning all the rules as a player, and then you can go ahead and storytell. There are different skills involved. No problem. Here you go. Here are the things that you as a storyteller need to go ahead and make this happen. An entire section on threat and the game master, how NPCs use momentum, all that sort of stuff. And it's all just laid out so neatly and so nicely. It's such an important thing to put, particularly in your quick start guide, but in any of these rule sets. People who are writing books out there, pay attention to this. Storytellers need to know how to run your game. It's not just about telling the players how to play your game. It's also about telling the storytellers how to run your games.
Absolutely. So well put together. And one of the rules, specifically when I mentioned a rule that was brought back that I guess was always supposed to be there, was simply you can have more than one person assist, but it pretty much automatically increases the complication range, too many cooks in the kitchen kind of thing. Very early on, I think our first episode, I incorrectly thought more than one person could assist because that's how I'd done it in a live game that I had run. And Joe had let me know that generally speaking, you can only do one person assisting by the rules. And he didn't have a problem with us doing more, but it wasn't really the thing. And so we switched that up and stopped doing that. But now you can have more people doing a thing as long as you are also increasing that complication range, which honestly also covered in the rules that you were mentioning, Josh, because that was something we didn't get for the entire first season. We were worried right. about how easy the game was becoming for our players because we weren't utilizing the rules. Why? Because it was buried. It was harder to find. The whole some things need to have higher complication ranges, so maybe people aren't going to roll four dice. Because why not roll four dice if you only can get a complication on a 20? That's not a big deal. However, if I now have a really big situation that you really want to succeed, but it's got a complication range that takes you all the way to 16, you're not going to roll four dice now. You'll roll three and lean on your assistance.
Yep.
And that makes a big difference. I have noticed that just by keeping an eye on the threat momentum flow and a huge combat scene with a whole lot of experienced players and great characters. And look, I don't think you guys, other than one time, got over five momentum. And not because I was stifling you, because you used it when you got it. And I was spending threat when I got it. And that flow kept going back and forth. It was probably one of the best examples of why the rules needed to be clarified.
Yeah, y'all covered that well enough. And my excitement over how well the rules are more organized in the game, that I don't really have a whole lot to add beyond I feel more comfortable if I were getting ready to run a Star Trek game now after having read the Quick Start Guide than I did previously as well because of the additional advice on how to actually use the things as opposed to just, hey, this is a thing. Because we straight up missed scene traits in our most of our first season because they weren't covered very well. And we just didn't know to use them to really to effectively use them to impact the scenes. We got much better at them as they went. And it's got a much better, just in that section, it's got better advice on how to apply it all and to make it impact the game and make the game more challenging and give you more of that sense of Star Trek imminent danger and threat.
Yeah.
Nice. See what I did there with threat.
Before we move on, though, I did have one point of clarification, Looney, just to go ahead and make sure that I understand. So reading, if you want to accept more than one assistant, it doesn't add, it doesn't increase the complication range. It costs either momentum or threat to do so. You get the first one for free, but then if you wanted to go ahead and add a second assistant, it adds, it costs either momentum or threat. Now, I have some questions about that. So the first thing is that normally when you are spending momentum and threat, there's an escalating scale. If I were going to go ahead and buy additional dice, one dice costs one momentum, two dice costs three momentum, three dice costs six momentum. So it's an escalating scale. Do assistants follow that same scale, or is it always one?
So based on what I read, I don't think it necessarily escalates. Yeah. I think it is just one for each assistant.
Yep.
By the way, it's written in this, yes.
Yep. Yeah. However, I know from what I have been doing lately at the game table, scene traits and spending threat for scene traits has been very helpful. I did that Monday night. I wanted to create a difficulty of two. I was spending two threat to do that, basically yep. one for each.
So you can increase the complication range that way.
So while I didn't necessarily.
Yeah.
Yeah. I could either spend threat to increase the complication range, or I could spend threat to increase the difficulty or whatnot. And yeah. In many cases, because I had a lot of threat at one point, I did both in one scene because it was a great lever to ratchet up that tension in what was yep. going on. And it worked beautifully.
All right, so that was question one. Question two, and one thing that, again, this might be buried in here and I didn't see it, but what if you are not just getting an assistant from – think about how they use assistant all the time in preservations where – Tanari is making a challenge. Tobor is going to assist because he has the scientist background. And they're also going to rely on the ship's computers for the Dalamis Christian for assistance also. Does that now cost momentum and threat, or is it only
no.
the physical? Okay, yep. So the ship is still free, and the assistant's still free.
Yep. Correct. So right. in this case, it's an enhancement to the existing system, yep. right? In this situation where we're talking about assistance, nothing changes. However, now you can add extra people Great. With the addition of threat.
Great. Fabulous. All right, Mr. Miller, the floor is yours.
All right. I'm going to take us to people, what the core of Star Trek is about. It's about people. It's about the characters. It's about the inhabitants of these starships, these space stations, these home worlds or these colony worlds, right? And I love this first peek and view at some of those changes to what goes into the characters we're going to be playing. First of all, there's a little bit of housekeeping, so to speak, where as opposed to disciplines, character sheets will now say departments. So characters will match ships. They have their attributes and the departments, which mirror the types of work that are available in Star Trek, right? And that matches the ships. So it's not two different nomenclatures. So if I say engineering or if I, the departments of the ship or whatever, the word doesn't have to change. That's just ease of play. So housekeeping there. But what I really like is the development of traits and species in that relationship. I've spoken about it with my gaming groups. And in role-playing games, there's a weirdness to species in that humans are considered the baseline. So humans are normal, right? They have nothing special. They have nothing taking them away. Every other kind of thing you can play is always special except for humans. WotC 5e has the varied human, so it gets a special thing, whatever. But my general point is humans are the baseline. Star Trek Adventures, as of second edition, will eliminate that thought process in that every species gets a species trait. It doesn't go into a lot of the details, but they have talked about in their live stream the live stream that Modifius did with Jim Johnson, Michael Desmuke, and several other folks, including the writer of the adventurer here in this quick start. So he was on that stream, and April Hill, who's the brand person over at Modifius as well. They did a great job of talking about how this will be working. So in the original game, in first edition, you want to play a Klingon. There are two specific Klingon talents that if you wanted to play a quintessential Klingon, you had to take four of your existing talent slots just to play a proper Klingon. Or if you wanted to play a Betazoid, you had to take one at least, if not two talents, to play a proper Betazoid. And many species only had one, several species had two, and I always felt that felt not good because now I'm either playing a weak Klingon just to have...
Just to say kapla.
Just to say kapla or whatever. Or I'm playing a Klingon who can't do some of the cool things that other Starfleet characters or other characters in the game might do. So the fact that they've addressed that by saying now the species will have all the things that make a person a member of that species, and now your talents are literally the abilities and things that you've learned, is very cool. Some of those things will still exist. So let's say you want to play a human who happens to be telepathic, you can still pick up that talent. But if you're playing a Betazoid, you don't have to use up that talent slot for that. So a Betazoid who wants to be a bold security person and a cautious engineer can do both of those things just like anybody else can and still have two other talent slots for other things. I love that.
Without losing their telepathy,
Yeah, I think that's just brilliant improvement to the overall design.
I agree, because as a character who plays a half-Betazoid officer and making the choice to pick up my empathy but not telepathy, that definitely impacted what I had available to choose for my character. So having the traits become part of the species, I think is fantastic. And a lot of the changes that they're looking at putting in that way, I think it's just going to streamline the game and make it better overall. There's a little bit that this quick start guide leaves you wanting for in those areas because it touches on them, but doesn't give you great information. As an example, in the traits section, it talks about the fact that traits apply to locations and creatures and whatever else. As long as the statement is true, it can be a trait. And then one of their examples is, if you're a Vulcan, highlighted in bold, in a desert, you'll find it easier to survive the hazards and perils. So it tells you that, but it doesn't give you anything to tell you what the trait for the Vulcan trait does to explain it. And even when you go down to the character sheet for the pre-gen character that is a Vulcan, it still doesn't do anything to help you understand how that works. But it gives you enough to know that the Vulcan is going to carry a trait that might make it easier to survive in hazardous environments, which I know is the thing. So until we get the full rules, or at least more of a sneak peek, it's hard to know exactly how excited to be about that. But it's a fantastic change to the game to allow you to have the coolness that you should have just for being a Betazoid or being a Vulcan without having to spend more of your character building resources to be a proper member of your species. I think that's great.
The point you mentioned about a little bit more information on the talents was something that was brought up in a couple different questions during the live stream where on Twitch last week, where a number of fans were asking questions of the panel. And one of the things that was mentioned is they wanted to make sure they put everything that was necessary in the guide to be able to play the adventure in the guide with those pregens. But they also wanted to save some of the goodies for the actual book versus putting it all in the quick start guide. And if the species trait didn't play into the adventure specifically, it probably wasn't going to be given a lot of service within this particular publication favor of putting it in with the rest of the species information down the road, because the different polities are going to be in there and all the species are going to be in this new book when it comes out. So I think that's when we're going to get a final look at all of the species talents and how they interact and what the final version of all the talents are going to end up being.
No.
I think there's more to come on that. And who knows, maybe we'll get another mini release of information prior to the actual book that'll have a little bit more in that front. But mostly as far as that goes here, it was all in service of this specific adventure.
But it's a quick start guide to give everybody an idea, and it's based 100% on a game in development.
I think it's more done than that, but I don't even think there's anything that's going on as far as writing at this point. I think it's probably final edits, but that's a guess. I don't actually have that information. Nobody actually answered
that. I simply meant they're not ready to unveil the whole thing.
If they're releasing it at Gen Con, they're done writing at this point.
Yeah.
Because they got to print off books and stuff.
One would hope. Looking at you.
Either that or second.
Who's not releasing a Gen Con, so that's why they can still be writing. But look, I just love the concepts that they're hinting at in regards to species and the things about character development that they're hinting at. And I can't wait till this is released and BC Homes gives me the ability to make 4 billion characters of 5 billion species in all of their infinite combinations, because that's going to be so much fun.
Yeah. All right, Mr. Myers, I think you've got the last one of the evening. So,
all right. I get to bring us home, huh?
You get to bring us home.
Okay. So my last takeaway slash thing that I'm really excited about plays right into the trait system, which is what I mentioned earlier when I was talking about advice for GMs. But specifically, I really like the addition of potent traits, that potency piece. It just makes them a lot more dynamic and gives good guidance on, especially after we discussed it and how it could have impacted previous scenes that we've played already, it gives good guidance on how a trait could progress if it gets worse or progressively get better, as opposed to just being there or not being there, which makes a lot of sense. The examples that they give, a potent trait is a trait that counts more than once. So instead of a room being just smoky, it's really smoky. They call it smoke and thick smoke too. So the trait's going to have a number after it, which represents how many stacks of this trait are present. And that's not going to be useful in every single situation. As an example, on the Breen asteroid, we were working on messing with the gravity controls. Once those were messed with, they were messed with. There's not, unless like somebody found a way to really like clamp it down so nobody could move, there's not a lot of stackability in that. But if you're running a scene where the players have created a trait like we did in that same episode, where we were venting gas from the nacelles to create a fog bank inside this loading dock slash hangar our shuttle was in, to use as a smoke screen so that we could sneak out and attack the Breen, because we're supposed to all be unconscious, and this way they don't see us coming, give us a little bit of an element of surprise. That trait 100% could have used this mechanic, because when we first started venting it could have just been foggy.
Yep.
And if we continued venting, it could have gotten worse and become thicker and caused more super foggy and caused more of a negative, or increased the difficulty for things like phaser fire, etc., because you can't see your opponents as well. But then it could also be affected by in-game actions, like we continue to vent it, it gets worse. The Breen to release it, it gets worse. If the Breen started trying to vent it, the guys in the control room, and they were successful, or the GM spent threat, since we would have had, say, super foggy 2 or super foggy 3 going on, one action of spending 2 threat or whatnot to remove the trait as they try to vent it wouldn't do it. They'd have to work on venting it and get some of it out. So we go down to really smoky 2 and then get it all the way down to just smoky 1 before they could fully clear the air to be able to then see us clearly and attack us. I just think that piece of dynamic shifting for certain traits on certain scenes and certain environments just adds a whole new level of complexity without making it hard to understand for how much we can impact and change the environment as players, because players can spend 2 momentum to create a trait too.
Yep.
Or it can be set up as a task depending on how the storyteller deems it. So from the player's perspective, knowing that we can continue to advance that foggy scenario to make it to the point where we could move around completely and they couldn't see us at all, instead of just making it slightly obscured, we could go for full on pea soup. That gives us a lot more flexibility in how we choose to approach the problem or the scenario or scene to navigate it and come up with cool and interesting ways to defeat it or to solve the problem.
Super Foggy 2, Electric Boogaloo.
Love it.
Shabadoo. Yeah.
Show like, enough.
Yeah. I love potent traits, and Glenn, it makes my heart sing that the things that you pointed out is, oh yeah, it could have been super useful here or super bad for us here. That was exactly one that I was thinking about too, particularly the one where you guys were blowing out the buzzard scoops to go ahead and create that room. Like we said in the pre-show, if you guys hadn't steamrolled through the Breen and taken their lunch money and insulted their parentage and all that stuff, then maybe that would have had some impact. But you guys blew through them so quickly, it almost didn't matter. But knowing that could have been in my back pocket, that would have helped. I think that could have helped a lot of things, I think, in that adventure feel a little bit more dynamic. Yeah, I'm really super excited about potent traits. I think potent traits are going to be a lot of fun. So,
I concur. I even look at an adventure you ran, Josh. Imagine if signal jamming or encryption had encryption 3 difficulty or what have you. Those are the types of things that would be very cool. Or the complication, because it only had a standard whatever, somebody rolls that nat 20 and now there's a complication. Now it's encrypted 2 because they actually hit a firewall, which caused a reaction in the program. So now it went up a level. So it's not done. Not only is it not done, but now it's more complicated or whatever. Or it dropped a second wall, and the second wall is 2. Like, let's say they succeed, but they hit that complication. Okay, you cleared the first firewall, but you did something that got noticed, so a second firewall dropped, and this one's more complicated now. Little things like that are great with either because a complication got rolled or because I'm sitting on 6 threat that I haven't decided how to spend yet. I'll drop 2 for that to make that kind of cool. I think those are nice dials and levers that we now get to play with that's a little more telegraphed. I've said it before on our show. I've answered this question or responded to questions about this. There are some GMs who run this game that have spoken about, and they're not bad GMs. They just have a different style or whatever. They rarely use threat, and I can't understand that. But I will say this. What I love about threat is I, as a GM, no longer feel guilty when I do something to put the brakes on the advancement of the players, because it's part of the game. They see it. I see it. I'm just playing the game. It's like you play Monopoly. Nobody gets super mad when you land on Boardwalk in this hotel because everybody saw it coming, right? It was always there that you just rolled into it. I love that aspect of this. I feel much more like a part of the troop when I play Star Trek, in a different way than I feel that in some other games. And my players generally, certainly the ones in my home games, know I'm part of the team when it comes to having fun in these games. But certainly when I go to a convention, that meta currency, when I'm playing with strangers, that's the whole ball of wax.
Let me glom onto something that you'd said about scene traits in particular and how to go ahead and make them. So in the game that, or the mission that I ran at a Catacon, the kind of Cthulhu-inspired Star Trek Dark Frontiers, the party basically winds up on a ship where the entire crew basically has been slaughtered, right? So there is already the scene condition mass casualties because the crew basically needs to wade through room after room of death and destruction, right? Now that there are potent traits, it's probably more appropriate to go, because mass casualties as a scene condition is something that could be bought off fairly easily under the original rules. But now making it a potent trait, like mass casualties 2 or 3, means that they've got to invest some things to go ahead and actually get that bought off so they can go ahead and function properly. And I think it underscores the depth of what it was that I was trying to get them to realize better than maybe just saying, okay, there's a scene condition, that kind of thing. Absolutely.
And as we think outside of the box with them and we come up with scenes to apply traits to, the traits could also become a great way to support the narrative, especially if you're working with unstable environments. Like, as an example, if the building that we were in the game that we played last night, Liwanika, for the conclusion where they're trying to get up the stairs, if that torpedo that was loose had hit the building, say, and now the entire building was unstable and shaky, right? So now you've got unstable. And that progresses because nobody's fixing it. It just gets worse. A little while later, it can become unstable too. And now the shaking of the building and the instability of your environment is even stronger. It's impacting your ability to climb stairs, just move across floors, or go with an ion storm or any other kind of storm. As the storm progresses and gets stronger, the trait gets stronger for whatever jamming or other effects that it's having. And it can add to the narrative as well to have that be physically represented by difficulties getting worse as the storm progresses. And I think that could be a really good time as we boldly go into new environments in the rest of season 2.
All right, we're going to go ahead and step away to go ahead and record our Patreon exclusive portion of this episode. So for those of you who are not Patreons listening out there, we'll be back in just a moment. are back from our Patreon exclusive content. A reminder that if you want to hear our Patreon exclusive content, as well as get early access to all of our episodes and invites to our Patreon only games, which include Star Trek Adventures, you can go check out www.patreon.com/TTJourneys to figure out how to get in the action there. We really appreciate the support. It helps keep the show running and keeping the show supported and everything like that. And so, yeah, we really appreciate it.
The lights are on and the motors are humming.
Exactly. We love our Patreon. Please, if you'd like to consider supporting the show, that's a great place to do it. So. That does bring us to the end of our episode this evening. As you can see, we're super excited about the second edition rules and how they're going to come out. This is not going to be the last time that you hear about this on the channel here. We're really excited to go ahead and get the full book in our hands so that we can start digesting some of the other changes that aren't included in the Quick Start Guide, like maybe what we just talked about on the Patreon exclusive. Maybe join Patreon and find out what we want to talk about there. But in the meantime, let's see here. Next week on the show, so we talked about this at the top of the show, we have a big feature of Big Adventure Game by Alex Vigna. Alex was on the show a couple of years ago talking about his Dread Realm Lemordia. Yeah, he is back with a brand new game. I'm really excited to be showcasing that. I have a great actual play that's coming up, as well as an interview with Alex here. And then our game review at the end. That's what you'll be hearing for the next few weeks here on the show. But in the meantime, thanks very much for listening, as always. I hope you enjoyed the episode. I'd love to go ahead and hear what you think about it. Details are in the show notes down below. But with that, everybody, thanks again for listening. And yeah, we'll talk to you again next week when we bring on Alex to go ahead and talk about Big Adventure Game. Until then, have a good night. Thank you for joining us. This has been Tabletop Journeys. We would love to hear your feedback on our show today. Join us at www.ttjourneys.com, where you can subscribe to the blog to leave comments and see all the content that we publish beyond the podcast.
You can also stay in touch by subscribing to our Twitter, Tumblr, or Instagram at TT Journeys, joining our Facebook group, Tabletop Journeys, or by sending an email directly to podcast@ttjourneys.com. Our full episodes come out every week on Friday, and every Tuesday features actual play and gameplay showcase episodes. Looking for early access? You can support the show and get episodes before everyone else at www.patreon.com/TTJourneys. Check it out today and see all the awesome benefits we bring to our supporters.
Lastly, if you're listening to us on Stitcher, iTunes, Podchaser, Spotify, or Audible, you would really appreciate it if you would like and subscribe to the podcast on that platform. Thank you for listening and for being a part of our growing community. And we bid you fair tides, friends, for legends await.